Welcome to episode 15 of the What's Up podcast, recorded on the 21st of July, 2017. My name is Martin.
Hi, I'm Ali.
Hello, I'm William.
Today we're going to discuss through a few different news stories that have caught our eyes in the last couple of months. There's a bit of Star Trek science, an event from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and a story that I want to tell you about, but...
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
The person I'm going to mention, though, is a little bit of an apology. We've not had a podcast out last month. The reason for this was a combination of us being on holiday and Ali being away to a conference, which we're all sorry about, except for Ali.
But I do love talking about how nice it was. So yeah, you can feel free to ask me more questions on that. That's
definitely work.
It was work. It was, yeah, I'm still feeling jet lagged. You know, that kind of British citizen abroad for a week and now, oh my God, I haven't slept so well.
And where were you at this conference?
This was the United States Virgin Islands, which is right next to the British version of same said Virgin Islands. And we were staying on a boat for the week. But yes, there was a conference and we were there every day. And it was hard work. And it was all about active galactic nuclei, which again, I don't get to talk about in today's podcast. But someday.
It will happen. One day.
When we finally let you off the leash. Okay, so the first thing we did mention was going to be a little bit of Star Trek science. So William, tell us about this.
Yes, this was the intriguing story about the teleportation of particles to a satellite, which was called that in lots of news reports. The BBC had a headline about scientists teleport photons, which sounded ridiculous. And so went to read this and did some digging about it. And the first thing to point out is that this is not Star Trek type teleportation. Which might not be a surprise because that's kind of really, really hard. The thing which surprised me more was that I was expecting it to be a case of, you know, scientists publish paper about something serious and sensible and scientific, and papers then get hold of it and turn it into something slightly misinterpreted. So I went and looked at the paper, and the paper is called Teleportation of Particles. It's like, oh, right, okay. So they were going down that line. But the reason for this is my complete lack of knowledge that actually quantum teleportation is a real thing, which is different to Star Trekian teleportation.
Did they own the word first?
They didn't.
Oh,
no. So there was some sort of little debate I found where people were arguing about they shouldn't have called it this because it's misleading because everyone thinks something else.
Yeah, fair enough.
But,
yeah.
But equally, as somebody pointed out, we wouldn't be having the conversation if they hadn't called it that. The fact that they called it something kind of cool.
So you're saying this was clickbait, right?
It was clickbait. It was quantum clickbait.
Quantum clickbait.
Yeah. So what they have done is pretty phenomenal, actually. And I can't even begin to properly describe it. I was looking this up and it said something about, it said, to understand quantum teleportation, you need to have a good grounding in linear algebra, quantum physics, projection matrices, and Hilbert spaces. So,
right,
moving on.
Al, you've got all that, right?
I'm sure it's on my CV somewhere.
Yeah. Basically, this comes back to this little rather amazing idea of how you can entangle particles. So you can put particles like photons or atoms into a sort of a state in which they are sort of interdependent on each other. So you can then do something to one of them and it will have the opposite effect will be seen with the other one.
This is the spooky action at a distance court.
Because this happens over long, long distances, the same thing. And as you say, Einstein didn't like it and called it that, which he just said. what they've done, it's not quite just as simple as that, though. What they do is they entangle these things, then they fire. So you have particle A and particle B, you entangle them, you fire off particle B using a laser with a telescope, and you fire it towards a satellite in their case, and then you make particle A, which is still down on the ground, interact with another particle, and particle B up in space mimics whatever that particle C was down on the ground. Still with me?
I think so.
If you imagine this as two arrows, you fire them off both pointing up the way, and then the one that's, so you fire one off towards a satellite, the other one you keep on the ground, you then turn the one that's on the ground upside down, and somehow the one that's going towards a satellite also flips over.
Sort of, yes.
But then you don't get to call that the same arrow in that kind of classic teleportation.
No, but the thing that's intriguing is that the reason that the particle B changes on the ground is dependent on whatever your particle C is. So let's say your particle C is a sideways arrow, right? But as soon as it interacts with the particle on the ground, it ceases to be in that state. So the one on the spacecraft then becomes the state which is the one on the ground. And so it's almost kind of, it ceased to be down on Earth, but it's now existing up there. So that's why they call it teleportation.
It's quite cool.
Okay. It's pretty cool. The thing that they get really, really excited about is the fact that to do this, actually, the whole problem is that you actually can't know the state of particle C on the ground until it interacts and is revealed, its state is revealed up in space, effectively. And the beauty of that is that if you're trying to transfer information securely for a quantum computer or cryptology stuff, then you have this way in which information is not discovered here, but you can transfer it a long distance away and reveal it.
And it should be hack-proof.
And it should be completely hack-proof, because if it's fundamentally, physically impossible for it to arrive at your end having been hacked without you knowing it's been hacked. I mean, frankly, it's just so mind-boggling. You have to take everything, all our kind of normal everyday understanding of arrows and all that's malarkey, and just throw it out the window. Because quantum physics just ignores all this. And the thing which really confused me is it sounds fantastic, and it's like, oh my God, that's amazing. It's faster than light, communication, all that stuff. But you have to know how the particles on the ground have interacted, send the information by a normal, conventional, classical method to the spacecraft to tell them what happened down on the ground so that they can undo. It's like a kind of a code, you know. Anyway.
So as long as you're sent the codex, you can decode it, but you need to send that codex by a traditional method.
Yeah.
And thus defeats the purpose.
No, because you can still, the information which you were transferring would be encrypted.
Okay.
But it would be like having the cipher for that code.
Not quite what it sounds like.
It's not quite what it sounds like, and it's very, very confusing. I think it's very, very clever, but that might be because I don't really understand it.
It does sound like another nice first in terms of quantum weird things that you can do.
Exactly.
I mean, it sounds like it's going to make somebody money in
someday,
terms of data security. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. And the fact that you can do this is pretty phenomenal. They've done it in the lab before, and I think it's been done over a small distance of maybe a kilometre or two with optical fibres. But to do it over 1,000 kilometres projected, you know, this satellite flying over a telescope, and you ping your photons off, and you've received them, and they're still entangled, and you can still...
I'm very glad you chose to talk about this today, because I'm sitting here going, I'm glad it wasn't me reading that particular...
I really enjoyed confusing my brain this afternoon. It's been fascinating. But I'm not sure whether I've helped explain it at all to anybody.
But at least you've clarified that it's not, when we say teleportation, it's not what you imagine as teleportation.
And this is like a handful of photons out of loads which they sent as well. So we're not only are we not transporting James Kirk, we're not even transporting like a small amount of information. It's like And then
I was hoping for a whole debate on, do you destroy the thing that gets teleported to the spaceship? Are you making a new Captain Kirk every time?
Exactly.
It always seems to go wrong in the TV show as well, which is, you know, just another.
I found myself getting into debates about what is information and whether that is being passed and whether quantum information is different to classical information. At that point, it's beyond me.
I think we've strolled way beyond the bounds
of
the astronomy podcast.
I think we definitely have.
Yeah, apologies. Sorry.
But speaking of transferring information long distances, there has been an interesting information that's been sent back to Earth this week, which is from the Juno spacecraft, which is currently going around Jupiter. And hopefully we've all seen the spectacular photographs that have come back from Juno.
Yeah, Juno is doing some awesome stuff.
Yeah, I love how quick Juno was to get it all online as well. They have this citizen science thing where they're basically like, here's the raw images. We passed over the red spot, the big storm that's on Jupiter that you could just about comfortably park two Earths inside. They still don't exactly know why it's as long-lived as it has been. We've seen it ever since people have first pointed telescopes at Jupiter. And this is the closest ever camera we've gotten to it. And they dumped all the images online and people are still processing them as we speak. So I've only seen about three.
Yeah.
And they were all very pretty, and it is a very iconic thing in the solar system. So it was nice to see a sort of zoomed in view of exactly what's going on. Yeah,
and I agree with you. I think it's just lovely the way NASA, they basically sent out the pictures of sort of raw images and just said process and share.
Yeah,
which is just lovely.
Get to work, Photoshop.
It's a really different way of doing things. And but it also kind of it gets into that interesting question of like, what, you know, the photos we show in astronomy, often people are like, is that real? Or is that a real picture? And it's like, well, yeah, but sometimes there's a bit of tidying up or colour balancing or contrast changing.
Is this a hashtag no filter needed kind of thing?
But, so it intrigues me. It's like, what would it... So to me, when people say, is this what it really looks like. That's always that thing of, if you went there and looked at it, would it look like this? And
well, I mean, you've got colours change. I mean, sometimes you're observing in the near infrared and you're kind of like, what colour should that be? Yeah. It's a very Terry Pratchett. Maybe it's a slightly off purple kind of a colour. You've also got the contrast issue, which is that if you really want to see fine detail, you've got to crank up the contrast. But then again, you wouldn't see that maybe if you were shorter exposures or just looking with your own eyes. But
I think it's unfair to say
anyone would complain.
Yeah, I think it's unfair to complain about this because most photographs you see in magazines, even landscape photographs, that kind of thing, they've applied filters, they've applied contrast. You've got high dynamic range cameras. Every picture we see doesn't represent what you see visually.
Yeah, and also, let's be frank, our brain is messing with everything we see anyway and doesn't really record things very accurately. But I think it's nice that in some ways NASA have opened up that loop. Rather than NASA giving out a picture and people going, oh, what did you do to it? What is it? How does it really look? It's like, no, here's the raw ones. This is what we took of a spacecraft. You go and play.
Yeah.
You do whatever you like.
And it gets their name on the bottom of the...
It says there was one of the ones I saw had like, you know, NASA, ESA, all the people involved in the mission. I can't
brackets
remember.
John from Essex.
Exactly. Well, that's just... that'd be like a dream, wouldn't it? If you're John from Essex. Oh, wow.
Like 100,000 retweets within a few hours or something. Yes.
Yeah, I'd retire. That's point.
So sticking with the images from space line, I made a reference to HAL 9000 at the beginning of the podcast.
Was that one? That one.
well, that was actually a reference to something that's happened on the I shouldn't say something that happened on the ISS. That sounds slightly over the top, but
all dead. No, sorry.
So the Japanese Space Agency started revealing pictures this week of something that they sent up to the ISS a couple of months ago. And this is a small robotic drone that is now zooming its way around the ISS. It is a spherical drone. It's about 15 centimeters across, so not that big, and it's covered in sort of fans, I suppose, on the outside, and it can push itself around. And the idea is it's got a few cameras on board and it just films astronauts doing stuff.
The thing that I read today said they spend 10% of their time holding cameras pointed at themselves and other astronauts.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's money in it if they can get cameras that are floating around doing that for them.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to be more stable than what a human would be able to do anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, like it self levels and it moves around, and it's got navigation cameras on board, and they've put sort of markers across the ISS so it can, if you tell it I want you to go from this place to go to somewhere else, it will just steer itself and it will find its way to the next place. And then mission control can also link up to it live. So if an astronaut's doing something, they can sit over their shoulder and watch what they're up to.
That's a bit scary, isn't it? It sounds cool. I think we also have to give them credit because they've made it look cute.
Yes.
It's very, very cute. It's got big eyes.
So it was looking cool. But I need to ask, maybe they've already done this. They must have an exterior version of something similar.
So they don't yet.
Okay.
But this is the first generation of this. That's what we're doing today. They've got plans to develop this further. And the plan is to develop it firstly. So it's an internal craft, just has cameras now. They want to push it further to do more things, and they also want to add on an external version so it can go outside the ISS.
So obviously no fans, but you could have fuel for thrusters or whatever.
Maybe jets or whatever.
Has to be a little bit more robust.
Yeah. I mean, this is all 3D printed. So the internal chassis and the external chassis are all 3D printed.
Right.
Now, the ISS has a 3D printer on board now. They've been developing one for use on board the ISS. So in theory, if this became damaged, you could possibly remake parts for it. And I think this is an interesting question because, and this is where my HAL 9000 reference came from. Well, how far do you take this idea? Because if you've got these drones that can go around the ISS and look over an astronaut's shoulder, if they could talk to you, if they could do communication from mission control, that seems useful. Is the next step to add a small gripper onto the bottom of it? So you can say to it, oh, can you grab me a spanner? And it can hover off and grab you the spanner and bring it back to you. Do you then make them intelligent? Take something like the Google Home Assistant or Amazon's Alexa, Siri, and start adding in that sort of functionality of droney, take a photograph of this. Droney, which wire do I have to cut for this to happen?
Is it actually called droney?
I don't know. That's what I would call it.
I mean, that's right up there.
I think it's got a cute name on that. It looks cuter than droney.
It does look droney. But you know, how far do you take? And then do you give the ISS this kind of, I'm not going to say intelligence, that sounds dangerous, but do you then make multiple drones which are all controlled by a central processor?
Well, I guess if there's a case for saving significant amounts of time, or maybe in an emergency, if you can holler out a quick command that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to type into a console or whatever for something shaking about, then, you know, that kind of thing's definitely worth thinking about. But I don't know. I mean, it's sooner or later we're going to have to address this as a species, you know how much autonomy are we giving to these things? And maybe you just wouldn't show Droney where the airlock switch is. just on the just off in chance. Case.
Don't teach him lip read. Definitely.
It is interesting.
But yeah, so this is the first step in what could be quite an interesting forward path. And it's worth having a look at the photographs and videos that are coming back from this device, because it's just cool to see what's going on board the ISS. And just that constant reminder that there are people going around the Earth at all times doing stuff.
I believe there's still a high definition feed coming from, they have cameras on the exterior that's constantly running, and they're actually doing it for a scientific reason, which is they want to test what happens to the cameras for long-term exposure in low Earth orbit. But the bonus is that you can log into a web page and get a constant view from the ISS. And you might not see much at nighttime. It's a little bit too dark and the camera contrast doesn't let you see some of the famous images from the ISS where you see streetlights and lightning flashes and stuff. But every so often the sun comes up and it looks amazing. And most folk, when you mention it to them, I had no idea that that was there. So this is getting streamed now. Flat earthers beware. Although I have already had somebody say that that's all fake and it's done in a swimming pool. So we're not going to go into that just now.
I think that camera was built by the STFC, which is one of the UK research councils, which is actually the one that we work for.
Some of our colleagues
down south actually built that camera.
Very cool.
Which is quite cool.
Can you get a live feed from the Droney,
as we're calling it? Not that I know of. No. I think Mission Control can currently do that. I suspect they wouldn't want to give public access. These astronauts are living up there.
I like the idea that John from Essex can drive Droney around. he's got a better eye for the good shot.
His pictures are awesome.
So we've covered the Star Trek science. I also made a Star Wars reference at the beginning of the podcast. So, Ali, what was that in reference to?
A long time ago, galaxy far, far away.
Yep.
Yeah. So this was something that's popped up recently. I'll get to the recent bit in a second, but I thought it was such a fun event, and it was the first of its kind. And it also ties a little bit in with the kind of thing that interests me. And we're talking cosmological scales now. So this is a supernova. Bog standard, they happen fairly often. Our Milky Ways, maybe every 50 years or something, a star will go pop. At the end of its life, explodes, becomes incredibly bright, can even outshine large parts of the galaxy. And we see them happening in loads of other galaxies all the time. And there are people who are active astronomers chasing these supernovae just to see where they are. Do they all look the same? You can tell a lot about what's happening just by sort of watching the fallout and the gas expanding. And I think if any of you want to see the highest resolution supernova, then Google 1987A. There are some videos now of this supernova that went off in 1987, and you can sort of see it evolve and the gas coming out and actually hits a shell and looks very pretty. That's
Although,
the main reason I'm saying
it's
high
video,
resolution.
Just to be clear, you don't mean like 30 frames a second?
No, this is like 30 frames in 30 years or something. Yeah. it's that kind of, it's just 30 frames. But it's nice because we've gone back and back and back, and you can see this thing actually change. So the main pinpoint of light has long since faded. That lasts for maybe a few weeks or something. And the reason I've even brought up supernova at all is that we've seen one of the most interesting supernova ever, because it got microlensed or macrolensed even into multiple images. So this is something that happens a lot in observational astronomy. If you put any kind of matter anywhere in the universe and you send some light past it, then the mass, the gravity of whatever is there, can actually bend and distort the path of the light. So Einstein was one of the first people to predict this, and he got confirmed. And we'll mention that when we come to the eclipse stuff later. But this happens on big scales as well. So massive galaxies, if they are in front of more distant galaxies, can actually bend the light of the more distant galaxies. And the bonus for observational astronomers is that you can get free magnification by doing this. So it's like holding a magnifying glass in front of something. So you're seeing flux that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to see. And NASA went out looking for these massive lens clusters. So galaxies, very complicated structures, lots of mass in front of us and more distant things. But we knew there's a lot of mass there. So we've been taking pictures of these things for quite a long time. So they're part of they get called the Hubble Frontier Fields. And it turns out that one of the distant galaxies, very far away, had a supernova in it and passed through the lensing cluster. But the lensing cluster has done such a messy job with bending the light from different angles that this distant galaxy has actually seen three separate times on the sky. So, I mean, you just have to wrap your head around that. So the same galaxy is seen three different times, different orientations, and it sometimes gets stretched out. You sometimes hear the phrase an Einstein cross or an Einstein ring. If you park the things perfectly one in front of the other, you do see a ring. So the distant galaxy would be a perfect circle. But it's never usually that simple. There's lots of galaxies, lots of lenses, and everything gets smooshed about. So it's very messy. And this complicated horribleness people have to try and model. But they saw in one of the images of this galaxy, the supernova went off. And then they went back and looked through the data and realized it had already gone off around about 20 years ago in one of the other images, which we weren't able to see.
Ooh.
And a team was even able to predict when image 3 was going to have its supernova, and they got it right. They predicted a place in galaxy image number 3 where this supernova was going to appear to within... I don't know, 20 or 30 days, they sort of said it's going to happen in roughly a year. And the error bars are relatively big because of the uncertainties to do with you can't quite be sure you've got all the mass worked out in your model. But they basically predicted the supernova, it appeared, so we've now, technically, the supernova has been seen three times, although it was never visible in the original image in the first galaxy image. And on top of all of that, the second image, the one that was the original detection, you actually see four images of the supernova itself, because the lensing configuration actually allows you to see the same event four times. The reason this is fun is because it allows you to do all kinds of tests of cosmology and making sure Einstein's right, making sure we know what our universe is doing. There's lots of caveats and uncertainties here, but the end result is that every galaxy image or every supernova image takes a slightly different path. So the light's coming to you from different directions, essentially. But because it's taking a different path, there's a delay. And this is how they were able to work out that one of the images happened 20 years ago, one of them is going to happen next year, because they knew the path the model was telling them. It's a shorter distance or a longer distance, so you can then calculate when you're expecting this thing to appear. So that on its own was a very cool story, and we've not talked about it before, so I just thought I would bring that up. It gets very messy. And the reason I've even mentioned it now is because there was another press release, there's another paper by one of the same people who'd helped make these predictions in the first place. And it now turns out they think they've seen the most distant star ever. So this is from a very distant galaxy. And normally you can't resolve stars that are far away. We can do it in our own galaxy because we're sat in it. We can do it for Andromeda because it has some massive stars that we can zoom in on with telescopes and just about resolve them. As you get further away, no chance. You can see the main galaxy itself. You can infer the presence of stars, but individual ones, you would need it to explode as a supernova, say. But then technically it's not a star anymore. It's a dying star. And so they think they've found a point source object in this distant galaxy that they're saying the only thing we can do to explain this is to say it's a highly lensed single star. So it's therefore the most distant single star ever observed. I haven't checked to see if the paper's been accepted yet, but I had a quick look through it. You're frowning at me, William. Am I talking nonsense?
No, I'm surprised that even when lensed, the resolution is such that you can get an individual star.
Yeah, well, they're saying it might be a factor of 100 up on where it would have been otherwise. So they think it's an A-type star or an O-type star. And there's a strong Balmer break in the spectrum, and they're sort of saying we can't come up with an SED, an SED spectral energy template fit, essentially, to tell you what that thing is. Because usually you're dealing with a rubbishy little point of light. But if you take a spectrum of it, you can actually spread that light out, and it tells you a lot more about the colours. And you can say that's a galaxy, that's a star, that's an AGN. I have very specific things I look for in our AGN. So they're saying a star is what fits this best. That doesn't mean it is a star, but I like the idea that just as a quirk of cosmic geometry, you can see these really distant things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to. So it may bear out. They'll obviously go back and take more images of it to see.
The predictive side of things, that's awesome. I mean,
yeah.
We can't...
There was about half a dozen teams, and in fairness to all of the teams, some of them were way off on their predictions, and some of them got right down on the money, but still had quite big error.
It was a sweepstake, basically.
It was a really nice test of just how well can we do these big, complicated lensing clusters, and it sounds like we're starting to get
better. And I would imagine that if they've multiple groups done this calculation and one of them has been right, they must have different constraints in all the different models. Yes. And by having one of them right, that narrows down the constraints. And this is how you sort of do science. Mm. You make a prediction, you observe it, you know some of that must be right, you do a different prediction, and that kind of narrows it down.
It sounds horrible, yeah. But if you've got four images and you tell your software where the four images are, you know the redshift of the lens, the software only has a few places it can place the matter to actually make those four things appear where they should appear. So that's essentially what they're doing. They're just every single constraint you can give it. Images here, that galaxy's flipped upside down, so it needs to run a lot of numbers, but you're sort of having to get statistical with it and say, well, if this assumption is correct, it should happen here. But yeah, it was a fun one.
Yeah, and actually, you said that the way science works is you make a prediction, you go and test it. The trouble with astronomy, generally speaking, is we can make sort of predictions in the sense of we can say, well, we kind of expect sort of the next little telescope might see this, or, you know, but you can't normally say we expect something to happen next week, because astronomical scales generally, time scales are so long that it's not a predictive sport. We generally are looking at what the universe says and then describing it, which is a bit different to a lot of science.
Yeah. We also don't have experiments that we can run.
No,
we can't. We don't have a lab that we can throw a ball bearing into a rock 10 times and get the same result.
Whereas that's the universe running an experiment for us. It starts the experiment and we go, right, we're going to predict the final bit.
We do suffer, though, because we can't repeat a lot of our observations. Exactly. Again, if you're lucky, you catch it at the right time, but then once it's faded, it's gone forever. And there's a lot of things that we can't rerun to make sure we got the numbers right in the first place. So this is kind of a lucky coincidence of everything happening in the right place at the right time. It was good.
There's a lot of galaxies, so it's a coincidence, but equally.
Yeah,
we keep looking, we're going to find the number.
Yeah, it's something like 20 trillion galaxies in the observable universe now or something. It used to be only, you know, a couple hundred billion, which is still an arbitrarily large number.
I guess two of the things at play here are, one, we're building better instruments that can see further, that can see deeper, that can see fainter. But also, I think the way astronomy is being done is changing to some degree, because you've got these big survey instruments now. So I'm going to look to you guys to get the terms right here, but LSST?
Yeah. Oh, that's going to be shiny when it's ready. The Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. It's a gnarly-looking beast, big sort of annular mirror, and it's going to be able to snap the whole sky every night, essentially, that it can see. And the numbers... You know, particle physicists, they've been dealing with big data for a long time with the LHC. They have to throw away a lot of their data because there just isn't enough hard drive space to store it all. We get interested about transients. So transient being a supernova is a transient, so something that goes bang in the night and then you go, ooh, that's interesting, and you follow it. LSST is good enough. It's going to flag a million a night. We don't have enough telescopes and people that can then go back and say, what was it? Take a spectrum. It's going to be really, really difficult. We're going to have to really pick what we want to focus on and make sure we're not missing anything really interesting, because this is another classic known unknowns and the unknown unknowns, because we know there's going to be lots more things out there that we haven't seen yet. And these kind of things will be sort of buried. And the LSST is going to see a lot that we haven't seen before.
So LSST is one of the examples. Mm. An example that I know is very close to William's heart would be the Moons instrument that we're actually building here in the Royal Observatory just now, which is going to take sort of suspecting these fingerprints of galaxies, but it's going to take hundreds of these.
Hopefully thousands. We could do 1,000 in one shot. And so of course, of a year, we're going to get, well, we want to build up surveys of millions of objects. In fact, we will try and follow up on some of the LSST targets at some point, probably. But yeah, I mean, we're following up, and it's
complementary science.
It's complementary. There's and the large surveys, when we have complete surveys, will deliver fascinating results. But it hasn't quite got that discovery space potential which LSST does. That suddenly you're going to go, you're going to have all these things, and as you say, I'd be like, what is this? What was that? What was this flash?
The LSST, I mean, it's comparatively easy to snap a quick picture in one filter, but to take a spectrum, it's much more time intensive. Yes. You need more photons, or you're just going to see noise. And so that's the issue, is the LSST's got really good at seeing these pinpoints. So things like moons will really help sort of even the odds a little bit and try and take spectra of as many of these interesting things as we can.
With its exobyte of data, which it will take in a year or something.
That's the LSST?
LSST, not moons.
Nice.
Yeah, whatever an exobyte is. Big.
It's a big one. I mean, Gaia is another example of this kind of thing, where you're taking astrometric data, so 3D positional points of stars all across the Milky Way.
A billion. Which sounds brilliant. It's a billion stars mapped to a precision we've never had before, which sounds absolutely amazing. And that's phenomenal.
Three-dimensional position and speed and direction they're moving in.
I mean, it's a staggering piece of kit, and it's going to, again, we're going to find loads of things. You start seeing these things wobbling, you start seeing them moving, all these sort of things. But then you kind of think, actually, there's, 400 billion stars-ish in the Milky Way? Maybe slightly
just
more.
Just one galaxy. Mm-hmm.
And so we've got a fraction of a percent.
Yeah.
Of one galaxy.
So keep funding astronomy. There's lots to map. Lots more to do.
Lots more work to do.
a plug for the eclipse.
One month from the eclipse in America.
Can you hear the sad faces in the room? Are any of us going to be present to watch the eclipse?
No. Although I've just looked, and if you're on a very, very tall mountain in Scotland, possibly on the west coast, maybe in the far north, and you look as the sun was setting, you might see the tiniest, tiniest fraction of the sun getting nibbled away as the moon passes in front of it.
I can confidently predict you will see a grey, soupy mess.
There is that possibility as well. If, on the other hand, you were in North America 1 month from today, on the 21st of August, mm-hmm. then you better have got yourself to the right part of the country, otherwise you're a disgrace.
And it's not, well, it's not far to get, because it's pretty much the entire central area.
You couldn't have scheduled it better. It's just, it's cutting straight through middle America, Oregon, all the way down to Florida.
It's pretty much top left, bottom right.
Yeah. Everyone in America will see an eclipse of some size. It's just, and pretty much the full strip of America will get totality. Phenomenal.
I guess this is where we have to give Einstein his plug, because it was actually one of the solar eclipses that allowed us to see starlight getting bent by the sun. Because the only time you can see stars is when the moon's in the way of the sun, and you want to see where those stars are close to the solar disk. And they were able to measure that the star was not where it should have been if you look at it when the sun's not in the way. So it was one of the first proper tests of GR.
That was predictive astronomy.
Predictive astronomy. So it's a month from today, so the 21st of August, and it's in the evening UK time?
It's just...
After sunset, basically, or around sunset.
Yeah, as sunset. If the sun wasn't setting, we would see maybe like a 2-3% eclipse, but the sun, it will just be going below the horizon, unless you're in the very far north.
Yeah, and so if you're going to watch a live stream of this, what sort of time would you be looking to... What sort of time do you think it'll be?
Afternoon stateside.
Afternoon stateside. Yeah, late night for us. Okay. So it'd be more like kind of...
So after work, log on and see if you can find a live stream, because there will be loads of live streams.
Yeah, there's bound to be NASA TV is probably going to be doing some things. That's a good place to start. Yeah. And then the SLU guys. And I think there's actually an eclipse truck that has like a solar-powered Samsung thing. So they had that for the last one in the island chain, wherever that was. And they're going to drive it up some mountain somewhere, and then you might get a nice view from there too. But ultimately, you just need a spot with no clouds and somebody with a kit to put it online. So there'll be tons.
I'm sure solar-powered eclipse watching is a bad idea, but that's
a
different discussion.
They've got batteries underneath it. Like, oh, always the engineer getting in trouble. Yeah, they had a truck full of batteries underneath their solar panels. So it was enough to power it through the 7 minutes of totality or whatever they get.
Okay, well, I think we'll call it there then. Thanks very much for listening.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.